Hey, everybody, and welcome to Learning from Smart People. I'm your host, Rob Oliver, and with me today is Rick Jordan. Rick Jordan is one of America's leading voices on business, entrepreneurship, life, and cybersecurity. He's been a frequent expert nationwide on ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, a featured speaker on NASDAQ, Harvard Clubs of Boston, New York, Mercedes, Coca-Cola, West Point. The list goes on. Rick, listen, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Yeah, my man, it's great to be here. That's a long intro. I need to ask my people to tighten it up a little bit. There's a lot there.
Dude, you're an accomplished person, and it's hard to take all of the stuff that is Rick and roll it into, you know, not that we're Rick rolling you, but just take all that stuff.
That's going to stick, my man. Be careful, you know. Yeah. I'm going to Rick roll you.
Exactly. So, listen, tell me a little bit about you've started your own company. You kind of went from the bottom to the top. Tell me about kind of where you started and how bad things were at the beginning.
Man, that's a great question. If my life can almost be segmented by traumatic experiences, and as I'm sure a lot of people have that scenario, right? And it's almost like at this point, I feel like I've lived maybe six or seven different lives. But one of those was, you know, a really happy occasion with my kids being born, my twins, my son and my daughter, Richard and Ariel. And that was 2007. 2 weeks prior to that, I found out that I was going to be laid off by Best Buy, where I was working. And that was intense, man, because, you know, thank God for Bill Clinton. And you'll probably never, ever hear me say that phrase again, because he put FMLA into effect. He's the one that signed that into law. And I had I was working there for 7 years. I was in their B2B division. I wrote their sales playbook. I was even the original Geek Squad agent in Chicago back in 2003. And when this took place, I was like, okay, no problem. Dude, it was really a really grateful time, because I was able to take 6 weeks off with pay, because I had all this accrued vacation and sick time under FMLA just to be with my kids. And I had, even during this whole restructure and everything with Best Buy, I had friends there that even said, listen, man, you know, when you come back, we have to keep you for 30 days by law under FMLA. But then they've already said that we need to let you go after that point. So I had another 30 days of just being paid and not even having to go into the office. So it was something like 10 weeks I had to get everything lined up.
Wow. Now you've got your 10 weeks done, and all of a sudden you find yourself no job at home. Yeah. And you've got two kids to, you know, two brand new babies to feed. What's going on? Like, what are you thinking, and what's the plan at that point?
Yeah, man, I never was really concerned about money, and I never really have been. I have a great spiritual foundation, and I've never seen money as something to strive for either. It's always been a tool, something that can help you accomplish an end result, an outcome. Now, I've always seen it that way. Money is important. We need money. That's the way that the world works. And I also feel that the more you have, the more good you can do and the more fun you can have too. You know, like I said, it's a tool. But during that time, man, there were some tough decisions, because sometimes when you're just making, you know, you bring in $900 for 1 month because you're just starting a consulting business at the time. Like, well, do I pay my mortgage or do I feed my kids? You know, those were some of the literal choices. And then later on, it was throwing, or do I keep the power on to keep the breast milk cold in the refrigerator? Or, you know, so it was just crazy times, man. And I remember there were times when the power did go out and I needed to run an extension cord. We lived in a condo at the time, run an extension cord out to the common area just for the refrigerator to keep it on for 2 days until I had some accounts receivable come into where I could just, you know, pay the $150 to have my power turned back on.
Wow. Let me just on a side note.
Yeah.
When you find out you're expecting twins, like what's that expression? Like, what's that feeling, dude, like?
What's weird, you know, is that I kind of had like an instinct even from the beginning. And it's almost like subconsciously my mind was open to it anyways. It was our first, right? My wife's and I, it was our first kids. And everyone thinks, oh man, you had twins. It must have been a lot of work. When you don't know any different, you just do. And that's what, dude, it was awesome, because the day I found out, I was like, 37 different thoughts go through your head from the day you find out that it is actually multiples. The first one is just when you're looking at the ultrasound, man, live, it's just utter joy. that is just the best thing in the world, man. Thinking I'm going to have two kids, you know, and then all the crazy stuff comes after the joy. Like, holy crap, how am I going to pay for this? What am I going to do? Now we have to get a bigger car. You know, everything else comes after that sheer joy.
Yeah. No. Okay. So this is not my one-up story, but the fact is, I'm not sure if we talked about this on your podcast or not, but
you have triplets, right?
Yeah. I've got triplets. Yeah. So I can relate exactly to that experience of getting the sonogram with twins. We did the pregnancy test. We're expecting, she does her first sonogram. There's two of them in there. And I'm like, oh, this is fantastic. We're going to have twins. She went for her next sonogram. They said there's three. And I'm like, all right, stop the sonograms. This is just, they're multiplying in there. I can't handle any more than that. But like you said, it's an experience you don't know any better. So you have to figure out how to work through it. Because I would imagine there are a lot of people that would look at your situation and say, I don't think I could handle that situation. I don't think that, like, I think twins would be too much for me to handle. For you, it's like, listen, we're having kids and I don't have a choice but to handle this. Do you think that that relates to life at all?
Oh my God, that's everything in life. You know, and I've seen that because remember how I was saying that most people's lives, I think, can be segmented as far as traumatic experiences. You know, my dad passed when I was 16. You know, I was fired from my first job that I thought was going to be my career when I was 18 because of a situational ethics deal, you know, to where they just replaced me with somebody else who was threatening to leave the company. So they fabricated stories to kick me out. You know, so I mean, and the list just goes on and on, man. Even to, you know, I'm an ordained pastor too, and I helped launch three churches in Chicago. And churches are great. I will never tell anybody not to go to one because I think they're an important part of our society, of our culture. You know, but there's some stuff that goes on behind the scenes because pastors are still people, man. They're still human beings, which means they're going to be fallible. They're not going to be perfect. And they get compromised, you know, and most of it always comes down to money. Almost every single scenario in my life comes down to money. So when you have to roll with these things, you just start to, I feel bad for those who avoid confrontation and those who avoid tragic scenarios in their lives, because I really feel that it builds your character and it really shows who you are, because you can either succumb to it or you can rise above it. And in those moments, I know that most people have the ability to press on and break through and just be a greater leveled up person on the other side to go help others.
Let me just say this, that with churches, as with anything, it's a perfect place until you put people in it. And
yeah, for sure.
And the fact is that people are what cause the problems in just about everything. And it's kind of a funny thing. I do a lot of speaking to medical professionals. And the joke is, you know, can you imagine how much easier all of the medical practices would function if there weren't any of those gall darn patients that showed up all the time?
No kidding.
Right?
You got it. Yep. even in that, you know, because I mean, I've worked with pastors who have had drug addictions. I've worked with pastors who have had, you know, women going on the side. You know, I mean, all this stuff happens just like really in business, you know, that it's just life. The same life stuff that happens outside the church happens inside the church. Now, that's the bad side of it. But on the other side to what you're saying, you know, the patients, right? So let's say the parishioners or the congregants, you know, because they're there, they demand so much of pastors too, man. It's one of the highest, highest stress jobs that exists. And I'm grateful for those that faithfully stick it out their whole lives.
Yeah. And it's one of those, it's a reminder of that is such an important role that a pastor plays, because what they're doing is the reason why there is so much stress on them is because there's a need for the services that they have. And I think that's really kind of transitions as well into business. The reason why a business exists is because there are customers that need that service. So, so as you're talking, as we're talking about this, to go back to the previous story, you're talking about kind of being at the bottom. You are laid off from your job at Best Buy. You're looking to make some money. You start your own business, and you said it was a consulting business. Tell me about how you start that business, what kind of service that business provides, and what's the story of your business?
You got it. I always had this, you know, there's been the question that I've been asked before, are you born an entrepreneur or are you made an entrepreneur? And I think that both are true in a sense. Me, I've always had that itch. So even 7 years before this, I always said, I'm like, I need to do something myself. Because when I was 20 years old, I'm thinking, I would love to have recurring, stable revenue or income in my life. So that's what I always look towards. So when I started the consulting business, I'm so grateful, man, because my very, very first client was a Buffalo Wild Wings franchise owner that owns now 7 restaurants. And he was the one when I was still working with Best Buy, because I met him while I was working with Best Buy and I helped him while I was there. He's like, hey, man, if you ever want to go on your own, I'm coming with you. You know, because I believe in you. And then for 2 years, he kept pushing me. And the reason why I didn't during those 2 years, even though I had no kids, man. So I mean, I had a mortgage, whatever, but there wasn't much financial risk during those times when I didn't make the decision to launch myself into entrepreneurship. It's when the trouble came, the turmoil came. I'm like, well, I guess now's the time. Somebody might call that a little backwards, but I really felt that was the time. If there's one regret, man, that I have is that I didn't start sooner. And for 2 years, he was pushing me. And when he came with, that was that $900 a month that I was talking about, because he was a recurring client who I sold block time to. All I cared about was when I started, it's like, well, if I can't count on anything else, I know I can count on this $900 a month from this dude. And then things went up from there because I learned how to provide better services. And just that initial year was really just structuring things how I needed it to be. And it takes time to do that, because when you start out, man, you're gonna make poor decisions. You're not gonna know what the heck you're doing. And the only way to actually figure that out is to actually do it. Anybody that's listening, man, I would encourage them to just dive right in. There's a time, this is a Walt Disney quote, one of my favorite ones, man, is that there's a time to stop planning and start doing. And I believe that time is pretty much right away, and that you can plan and do at the same time. It's important, because if you don't gain that experience immediately, you're not going to be able to adjust on the fly as you keep rolling. You have to just dive right in and adjust and adapt as things hit you.
What kind of business is this? What kind of consulting are you doing it?
IT consulting. So I was the, you know, if you think about like local handymen that run around and, you know, and fix a door in your house or something like that, that was me in the computer realm. Now, even though I had training and experience, my first gig in computers was when I was 18, and I built 150,000 computers and 12,000 servers for Merrill Lynch. It was all me, and I shipped them out. That's where I cut my teeth, man, was in what we call the enterprise segments. Big deals, right? I carried all that around. So here's me, this dude. I mean, even when I started with Geek Squad, it was funny because I thought that I was going to be, it was this new B2B division, right? I thought I was going to be building networks and connecting businesses. And then my very first call was, hey, I'm here to scrub your porn. that's all that we did, you know. But even when I went into business for myself, you know, even B2B, that's a lot of what I did at first, man. It was almost just like Geek Squad glorified as a consultant when I started this. But then I immediately structured for scale and to build. I immediately started outsourcing things that I did not want to do, so I could just only focus on growing, on selling, on building a business, on investing back into this so I can hire my first person.
So tell me about that process. I love the idea that you're figuring out what is it that you have to do and what is it that are the essential elements of your role and what can you outsource. What did that process look like for you? How did you work through that?
What I started doing first is that I started looking at all the menial tasks, right? Now, there's some things that when you're a one-man band, when you start out just as an entrepreneur, with no funding, meaning self-funded, and you're just hoping for the accounts receivable to come in on time so you can pay your bills, you start looking at, I would encourage people to do this too, you start looking at the tasks that are outsourceable. Now, I always say, you know, the right decisions are the ones when you're asking the questions for years down the road. So if you're only making $50,000 a year right now, or only making $100,000 a year right now, and you're thinking, oh, I've got this decision to make, the right question is, what should I do now? The right question is, what would I do if I was a $1 million business? And that'll tell you what you need to outsource right now. Because if you're not a $1 million business right now, you have literally everything under the sun coming at you. But when you get that cash flow going and you think, you know what, my time can be better devoted. It's a different question when you're a $1 million business than when you're a $100,000 business. It's a different question when you're a $10 million business, you know, which I am now, versus a $1 million business. Getting through those plateaus and determining what to outsource and what to delegate out is important to ask those questions when you're thinking and visualizing further down the road. Never just live in the present to answer those questions and make those big decisions now.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I remember I was in a training session with a lady who calls herself the productivity lady, and she outsources everything. She has somebody else clean her house. Yep. She has Walmart deliver her groceries, all of those things. And the reason that she says this is because two things. Number one, she is able to devote herself to the business during business hours. But then when business hours are over, she's able to devote herself to her family and spending time there. Because when you are in business for yourself and you don't have the capital and you don't have the ability to do that outsourcing, it just seems like there's more to be done in 24 hours than obviously any one person could accomplish, even if they don't go to sleep. So
yeah, you got it. I've talked to people who have been interested in selling, man, to your point right there. You know, they are only bringing in maybe $80,000 in total revenue. And they look at that as, hey, that's my income. And then they realize it's like, man, I was making $80,000 working for somebody else and I didn't have all the headaches. Because to your point, there is so much more. You know, when you're not a W-2 employee, there is so much more that can hit you. If you have to make decisions now, make them as if you're at that next phase already and start structuring. Reinvesting in those early days, just like a startup, man. I mean, most startups, they don't really take any money to begin with. They just need enough money to survive, pay their mortgage, everything else. Every single penny that I've done, even now, man, I don't take much. I mean, it was just 2 years ago, you know, to where there was a time period of reinvesting back into my business. And I showed my tax return to some of my key employees. So even though at that point we were doing $2 million in revenue, I'm like, look, guys, I took $58,400 this year. Right. That's it. Now, I've had other investments that I've built up, but there's times for that to where you have to. This is the difference, man. I can't stress this enough. This is the difference between building a business and just doing the job of working for yourself. I've seen that separation to where people are like, I'm going to build a business and do this for myself, when they're really just doing the same job for themselves rather than working for somebody else. Building a business requires that reinvestment. Building a business requires pouring into your people, pouring into your operations, and making self-sacrifices along the way as needed monetarily so that you can continue to scale and grow to the next level.
Okay, so your business starts out, it's you and you're making $900 a month.
Yep.
And
isn't that awesome?
Yeah, it's fantastic. But it's you, okay? It's me. Your business and it's your passion that drives it. And so today you say that you've got a business that's doing over $10 million. How many employees do you have? Kind of how expansive is your business?
Yeah, we only have 14 employees, which is pretty great. And now there's a lot of outsource that happens too. And I also just opened a global office. It's my people that are in the Philippines. That was probably one of the best decisions. I wish I would have done that earlier, man. And I'm starting to build more people over there. It's interesting over there too, because they have got to be, the Filipino culture has probably got to be one of the hardest working cultures that I've ever seen. You know, they really, really, really just want to please who they're working for. And they really, really, really want to be bigger than something that's just themselves. It's phenomenal, man. I love, I'm all for United States first, but I'm also very cognizant that it's a global economy. And if you can reach beyond the borders and help other people, go for it. That's cool.
That's awesome. It is such a correct thing that we are a global economy. And when you can take advantage of that, absolutely do. Tell me a little bit about what services your business actually provides.
Yeah, man, we're cybersecurity first. That shift took place probably about 7 years ago. It was almost like coming full circle for me, is that we started out as a managed services provider. What that means in layman's terms is just it's an outsourced IT department. Everything you would have an IT guy do, we do. So instead of hiring one person that you need to have all the competencies for like $150,000 a year for small businesses, you can get seven people that touch your account every single day for like 80 to 100,000. It's fantastic. It's a great structure. Cybersecurity became really, really big just a few years back because that's when ransomware started hitting. Yeah, but my skill set's a little unique because we dive very, very much into the world of insider threats. Because there's a very human component to cybersecurity. And I can never talk about this enough, man, because no matter what it is, you can throw antivirus, which by the way, doesn't work anymore. If anybody's using antivirus out there, you have to have next gen AI-based protection, artificial intelligence protection. You can buy some at Best Buy if you want. You know, Webroot is one that you can actually pick up at Best Buy. Anything else on the shelves, for general consumers I'm talking, anything else on the shelves there isn't even worth the pennies that you can spend on it. It's just stupid and it's old school tech. A lot of engineers in this industry, they'll just be like, hey, I'm going to throw software tools on it. And that's the protection. It's like the antivirus mentality. I'm good as long as I install this. You're not good. There's a response plan that has to be put in place. And it's still human beings are the ones that let down that drawbridge to your castle that is your business, because they are the ones that will click on those phishing links. They are the ones that will let just somebody walk through the door. There's a very human component to cybersecurity. So my team, we use technology to generate some of the alerts and artificial intelligence, but always we have a virtual chief security officer, CISO, chief information security officer, that analyzes all these alerts for all of our clients. And that's the human aspect. Dude, we've even caught employees trying to steal $25 million worth of a book of business, or siphoning off $6 million in case files on one of our attorney friends and clients that we have. You know, so that's the insider threat world. And that gets back to situational ethics, like we were talking before.
Sure. And in some ways, this goes back to what we were talking about with churches. The problem with the business is the people.
You got it.
All right. So you've mentioned the concept of situational ethics. Explain that concept for my listeners and tell me kind of what it means to you and how it applies.
Sure, man. I think pretty much everybody, you know, and I say pretty much everybody because I haven't met one yet. Pretty much everybody on this planet is a good person. I genuinely feel that in my heart. It's been conditioning and environment and everything else that kind of flips them to make bad decisions. And those bad decisions are typically based on a situation. So everybody has a baseline code of ethics, you know, and then they start to make compromises. It becomes easier to make those compromises through the years, but it's as the pressures of life start to pour in on you, you know, pressures like having twins and getting laid off. You know, I'm not saying I made a bad decision there, but that's the type, you know, or like the story where I was just brushing on, where one of our clients had a salesperson trying to sell off a $25 million book of business. The dude had back taxes and alimony and child support from three previous marriages that he was laid on.
Wow.
So, yeah, so most of this ethics, this is the premise, because I wrote a book about this. So the premise of the book is ethics is almost always an economic proposition. And I love the phrase that I hear all the time, and I say love, I'm being sarcastic, when money is the root of all evil. You know, it's actually a misquote from the Bible, because the real quote is money is the root of all evil. Or sorry, the love of money is the root of all evil. It's not money is the root of all evil. It's the love of money. You know, so that's when greed comes in. When they misquote that, because money, again, is a good tool, man. Everybody needs that. But the love of money, or rather the need from pressures in your life in that moment to try to pull you out of this pit from a bad decision that you made before, will cause you to make another bad decision. That's where the ethics become situational and make a good person cross over in a bad territory.
The concept of situational ethics to me, and maybe you can just give me some feedback on my thoughts, and that is the decisions that you make about what's right and what's wrong depend not on the reality of what's right and what's wrong, but on the situation that you're in. So, you know, when I was in college, we talked about this. It was a psychological experiment in which you're talking about, is it okay to steal? Is it ever okay to take something that doesn't belong to you? The situation is you've got a guy who, let's just say, for lack of a better term, maybe got laid off from his job and has twins on the way, and his wife needs medication that he can't afford.
Yeah. Yep.
Is it okay then for him to steal the medication because he needs that? And the question ultimately comes down to, does the situation determine what's right and wrong, or is there a concrete basis for this is always right and this is always wrong? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you're sort of even brushing over my scenario. You know, even what I said before, the power goes out. And I'm a guy who was laid off and had twins on the way. What did I do? I ran power into the hall and pretty much stole from the condo association in that moment. Now, that was for 2 days to keep the power on to my refrigerator. Was it right? Some could argue maybe yes or no. You know, that one was based upon survival, like literal survival for my kids is what I saw that. But I did send them an extra $30. I remember this. I did send them an extra $30 for my monthly assessment payments to the condo association after the fact. But that was one of those scenarios where it was asking forgiveness rather than permission because it was in the moment. Right now, other individuals, like the scenario that I was talking about with the $25 million, you know, I don't know if it was really right or wrong, you know, and everybody has crossed this line in some way in their lives. And if they haven't yet, they're going to at some point. Here's how I've defined ethics, right? Or when you cross those lines to where it's bad, it's when you do something to better yourself at the expense of another person. And that's the key to me, because what I did, I don't think what I did was at the expense of somebody else. You could argue if it was right or wrong. For me, my personal opinion was kind of neutral because I had every intention of paying back those dollars for the electricity that I borrowed or stole during that moment. But when you're doing something to better yourself at the expense of another person, that's where you're crossing into bad territory. And that's the situational ethics. So that, if I were to define what you're asking here, that's sort of the baseline. And the question to ask yourself is my decision right now going to cause harm to somebody else?
Got it. Rick, you have been fantastic. I really appreciate you being on today. Listen, if people are trying to find out about you, get a hold of you, where are you on the internet? What's the best way to find you?
Yeah, man, I'm. You can find me at all social platforms. Instagram is one of my primary ones. Then, of course, there's Facebook. It's at Mr. Rick Jordan. You know, which means if it's Facebook, it's facebook.com/Mr. Rick Jordan. Just follow, you know, I have a podcast that you were on too, All In With Rick Jordan. It's a lot of fun. We're in 28 countries now. I'm very grateful for that. I like helping people, man.
That is awesome. I would encourage people, go ahead and follow. He's got a great podcast. And I don't say that just because he had me as a guest. Was it Mark Twain or something that said, you know, any group that's willing to have me as a member is a group I wouldn't want to be a part of. So Rick, hey, you have been wonderful. You have established that you are indeed smart. I have learned from you, but it's time to establish your personhood. We've got three questions to establish your humanity. You ready for this?
Ask away, my man. Yeah, let's find out if I'm human.
All right. So what qualities do you admire most about your parents?
Oh, man, that's a fantastic question. You know, if I were to, 'cause my dad passed when I was 16. I absolutely love my mom's tenacity. And I'll tell her this to her face to this day, because just like we were talking about those tragic moments earlier, you know, that was a huge moment in her life when my dad passed and she had a 16-year-old son, an 11-year-old son, and a 10-year-old daughter. You know, I helped raise them in that time, but man, she pushed through and she continued to just do everything really at the expense of herself for the benefit of her kids. You know, her tenacity and her ability to just push through those moments are just amazing.
She sounds like an amazing person.
She is, man. She's a caregiver for her husband now, too, who had a stroke 5 years ago, a major stroke. I mean, no matter what's hit her in life, dude, she just keeps pressing on.
Awesome. What do you get every time that you go grocery shopping?
What do I get? All right. Usually when I go grocery shopping, it's usually my breakfast materials, right? And I call them materials because breakfast is like a utility meal for me. I have to start out the day right. My breakfast usually never consists of something that I typically want to enjoy for pleasure, which I believe in eating for pleasure, by the way, too, man. But it's egg whites, spinach, English muffins, grass-fed butter, and Honey Nut Cheerios. That's my breakfast. I have like two breakfasts back to back. Yeah,
that's awesome. I love it. At least you know what you're up to.
Yep.
Well, I was going to originally ask you what's your favorite quote, but you already gave me a quote from Walt Disney. So I'm just going to ask you, what is the coolest thing? What is the coolest thing about having twins?
Man, it's from birth, dude. You can see the difference in personalities and my unique perspective too. I don't know the gender of your kids, but mine are boy and a girl, Richard and Ariel. And seeing from birth how one is very, very much a boy and the other is very, very much a girl and how they respond and act to things. And if I can tag on one now too, I really feel, you know, I don't know if this can be measured yet, you know, because we can measure quantum energy emanating off of our bodies and everything else. And there's this theory of quantum entanglement. I really think that that could explain this crazy bond that those two have. Because even they just turned 13 last week and they still are each other's best friends, man. And they just know what each other is thinking.
That is so cool. Yeah. Listen, I've got a boy and two girls. So my thought was I've got one of each and number three is just a bonus. Rick Jordan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Man, my pleasure. Thank you.
It's been a joy. For everybody listening, thanks for tuning in today. Why don't you leave us a review? Check us out on social media. I appreciate you following us. I will remind you, as always, when you stop learning, you stop living. Have a great day, everybody.